This free program is paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a member, think about joining with us to help keep free speech alive.
Tips. KPFT will continue to broadcast the programming you enjoy and will always be Radio for Peace. I'm Dwayne Bradley, and this is KPFT Houston.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT in Houston. And now, Houston's only primetime radio program dedicated to news and concerns of the lesbian, gay, and transgender identity. This is Queer Voices.
Good evening. This is Jack Polinsky.
I'm Deborah Bell.
Well, and tonight we have the fourth in the series of the transgender special for Queer Music Heritage in the second hour.
Yes, J.D. Doyle's Queer Music Heritage. You wouldn't even believe there was that many transgendered artists in music, but he goes back from early times and really is a celebration, has been a fascinating series. Also, Jack Polinsky and I will be discussing the future of Pride Houston. We'll discuss the vote by Pride Houston not to move the parade from Montrose and to keep it in June, and the future of the organization. We'll also have
This Way Out.
And that includes News Wrap. This Way Out is the internationally syndicated GLBT radio magazine. And we'll have, I don't know, no telling what might come up tonight. The full moon is tomorrow.
Oh, it is.
Yes,
okay.
It is. And so it's the August 27th edition of Queer Voices. So what's up first?
Well, first we're going to play a little bit of music.
Okay.
Wanted you to know, and it's been on my mind. Well, have I told you in the last 5 minutes that I love you? This boy, I never want to let too much time go by. It's barely out the door and it's ringing. I pick up the phone. I say hello. Have I told you in the last 5 minutes that I love you? I just wanted you to know what is going on my mind. Have I told you in the last 5 minutes that I love you? You know I never want to let too much time go by. Now if you think we've lost our minds, well, you hit it right on the head. So crazy in love with each other, we just can't leave it unsaid. Have I told you in the last 5 minutes that I love you? I just wanted you to know what it's been on my mind. Have I told you in the last 5 minutes that I love you? You know I never want to let too much time go by.
And it is certainly a reminder of how so quickly we can lose people that we love. Jennifer Renee will be back with us next week. And J.D. Doyle will be joining us again live in the near future. Of course, we'll have his Queer Music Heritage. He puts it on a CD, and then we just play it on the fourth Monday of each
You're
month.
You're giving away our secrets, Deborah.
Oh, yeah, they're supposed to think that we got this whole big staff here of people doing. Sometimes we do. Sometimes we do have a full house. Let's do a little housekeeping, Jack.
Okay.
One is we did have a successful pledge drive recently, and this is a reminder for those of you that pledged to pay your pledge. Unfortunately, Queer Voices was not particularly supported, so we ask for you to please remember us and make some pledges in support of Queer Voices. This Way Out, which is a segment of our program, is produced at another Pacifica station, and they have very high production values, and there are costs because they syndicate that program, and they're going to start asking for a nominal fee to be paid each week so that we can continue to bring that. So hopefully our listeners who enjoy This Way Out will also support KPFT so that we can continue to bring that. We're on every Monday night, unless there's some incredible breaking news. We're
right,
usually
and
here.
We don't usually get preempted too often.
No, and we usually are here for the holidays because that fall on Mondays or close to holidays.
And what day does Christmas fall? It's near the end of the week, I think.
What day of the week?
Yes.
You don't mean the date?
Well, you can tell me that too.
Actually, I think it is like
Friday or
the
something.
The Tuesday. No.
It is a Tuesday, so we'll be here for Christmas Eve.
Yeah, that's right.
We'll be burning those logs.
Yeah, that's right. And, of course, we come on right after Interchange with Larry Payne, which starts at 7, and then we're on from 8 to 10, and following us is World Village Cafe. So that's your Monday night lineup on KPFT. They have a new issue of The Voice, which is our newsletter for the station, and if you pledged recently, you'll probably be getting a copy of that. It has the schedule and commentary. They've been playing it for all it's worth, the fact that there was a drive-by shooting here at the station, and it's made us extra cautious of security. And there are some costs involved in making sure that the people that volunteer their time here and the staff are safe, or anybody that's in this building should be safe.
So we lost our view, basically.
Yeah, we're going to paint something on there.
Yes,
or
we're
going to
paint the outside.
The skyline of Houston with little glittery lights or something.
Just like Reagan did in those housings up in the Bronx. You remember that story?
You said that you actually saw that.
Yes, there were these empty public housing that was, that they emptied out. And so what they did on these windows in the Bronx in New York City, that they painted like flowers in them and blinds or curtains and stuff. This is absolutely true. And it's so Reaganist.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, well, so let's get back on topic. You're listening to Deborah Bell and Jack Belinsky, and we both attended the board meeting this Saturday of Pride Houston.
Yes, we did. And the main topic that they were discussing was whether they're going to move the parade and festival to a different time of the year and to a different geographical location. And this was supposed to have been announced last January. However, jump in like you usually do if you need to correct me on it, because some of it gets a little bit fuzzy after time.
Yes, but that's true.
Pride did do that. In any organization who looks towards the future and says, maybe we've got to do things a little bit differently, I commend them, because that needs to be done by every organization. And usually most organizations are so caught up in what they do that they don't have time or the resources to look beyond their next immediate needs. So there was a couple things that Pride wanted to address. One was that the parade that happens in Montrose didn't really have room to grow. And we can argue these points, but that was one of the things they were looking at, but especially the festival. The festival took place on the Saturday afternoon, right before the parade, and the real concern there was it was hard to get those streets closed with the city, with the permitting system, and they kept changing, they're changing the rules to make it harder for that to happen, and the fact that, Houston is such a mixed area of residents and businesses, it's hard to block off people who live in that area. Even though there's only a few of them, there were still a couple residents there. And then the cost of being able to put fencing up, instead of like a square area.
And
it was
Jack
like
is showing with hand gestures.
Sort of like a finger area. Imagine all the fencing you have to put up to block out certain streets and leave certain things open. And so they fell in for the festival ever to become more than a one day, like it is in Atlanta and many other cities. It's usually 2 days. Or Friday, Saturday, and Sunday.
Well, essentially what they did was voted to nix the festival for 2008 because of, one, the organization is in debt. There are various viewpoints on why that is the case. One of them was, of course, we did have rain for the festival. It didn't rain on our parade, but it did rain on our festival.
Well, and that part of that fact, too, was that only about 1,800 paid people paid to go to the festival, and they were hoping for 5,000. So all of that expenses of bringing in entertainment and setting up and putting the fencing, et cetera, there's no way they can make money on that.
But in years, like, this was the third year that there had been a concentrated effort to have a festival in conjunction with the parade on the same day as the parade. We would do the parade, and at the end we'd go to Spots Park and listen to politicians and maybe some music and kind of all hang out together. And you know what? I loved it.
Yes, but that was because the parade was in the afternoon, and then you had that festival or rally.
Right.
And that was done by the caucus you'd have. But when the parade ends at midnight, it's a little bit hard to have something after the parade.
And then one year we had a festival over at the Multipurpose Center on West Gray.
And that lost tons of money.
But it was fun.
It was fun. Oh, I loved
it. I had a good time.
I did, too. It was great. There was a lot of organizations there, and that was a lot of fun. But unfortunately, it did lose money.
So, number one, no festival for 2008. Not produced by Pride Houston. Okay. Second vote,
was well, I don't actually remember them voting on that festival on at the board meeting.
No, they had already made that decision
but
the weekend before.
Yes, but I thought that was supposed to be a board decision.
Well, it was a board decision, but it was also they got input from the volunteer and the production team the week before. So it wasn't just the board making the decision. It was the board listening to the whole organizational structure, which is as it should be. So the second thing was about moving the parade and whether to take it downtown or leave it in Montrose. And after the results of listening to the community and the survey that was conducted by Pride Houston itself and overwhelmingly was against moving the parade out of Montrose and also overwhelmingly against moving it to a different date.
Yes.
Unanimous decision, keep it in Montrose in June. And I'm just at my own comment, as it should be. So we've got that taken care of.
Now, but that vote is only for 2008.
Right, because they can't project beyond that. Could be a whole new board by that next year. But we're talking about the future of Pride Houston, and some of the things that we have to consider are, one, Carol Wyatt, who was the president of the board, has submitted her resignation. She has listed various reasons for having done so. She pretty much was involved for about 3 years. She will continue to do things that will support Pride, but there is a new board. People are being interviewed. There's a nomination committee, and those people will be put forward in September and voted on. There's some board members that are not returning. There's some people that, because of the controversy of this past year, feel a little wounded and are kind of uncertain about their commitment to the organization.
And that happens to every organization.
Right. And so where we are is there's 13 board seats. Not all of them have to be filled, and better they not be filled than to have dead weight. In other words, board members that can contribute something, that can help raise money, who can help direct and guide the organization, who can build. I think there's a real healing that needs to take place within the organization at this point. So I want people to step up. If you've been dissatisfied in the past, this is a way to get involved. There's been criticism that the parade is just a big beer fest. Well, for some people, that's true. But you know what? It's the one day that our community comes together, no matter what aspect of the community that you are, whether you're a gay teen, whether you're in Loaf, the parents and friends, maybe you're involved in a church. When someone told me that when they saw openly gay and lesbian police officers walking down the street holding hands with their partners at the parade, that it just made them cry.
Well, sure. And there are, you know, there are so many other things. And, you know, I have to give a disclaimer. I'm one of the founders of Pride Houston, and you've been involved in Pride.
You don't have to disclaim that. You should own that and be honored.
Well, to be honest with you, this year it was a trying year.
Yes,
so
it was.
And then you're applying to be a board member. Now, you say that, are they still accepting applications?
Yes. And, okay. And the way they, recently there's been a revision in the bylaws, and the structure has been created so that if someone wants to get on the board, it's not just one time a year there's an election. There will be opportunities for people to apply and to that have something to offer who can join in.
Well,
so,
and in any organization, they really do need board members. You know, all of the organizations are looking for, just about all of them are looking for volunteers. But a person who steps up to be a board member, which is a governing board of a nonprofit organization, they really got to realize it's more than just attending meetings. And we ought to really do a segment on board members and what the responsibilities are. And it differs.
That's a good idea. Why don't you put that together
okay.
And tell me when it's scheduled for, and I'll get
And we'll all take notes because, you know, and I've been, and actually, if you're interested in becoming a board member, you ought to look into the United Way.
Mm-hmm.
They have seminars that go on, and unfortunately for some people, it's during the business day, so some people can't go to them, but they're usually very reasonable. And they talk about, I mean, because basically, you know, you're responsible. And I mean, just as Pride Houston is in debt. You know, and I didn't quite get the answer, even asked the question, but some of those board members are going to be responsible for that debt. At least I understand that to be, because, you know, most nonprofit organizations don't have any assets.
Well, a lot of nonprofits have assets, but whether that is convertible into cash is
right.
Not necessarily the same thing.
Yes, you're right about that.
But usually the way things are legally set up, the board members are protected from liability because you would never get anyone wanting to be on any board. So this recent revision to the Pride Houston bylaws were overseen by an attorney who's familiar with bylaws and the codes of Texas, and so being in compliance is very important. And you know, it's like I said, I want people to step up. I want them to find out about what Pride Houston is about. If you think it's just a drunken beer fest, then let's get in there and do something to change that. The most damning words in any group are, "But that's the way we've always done it." So we can look at new ways to do things and constructive. And like I said, let's put this past year behind us. We can still acknowledge it. We can still own the history of it, because if we don't remember our history, we're doomed to repeat it. That's one of the truisms of the universe.
Well, as you say, that's the way it always was is not always a good phrase, but at the same time, you cannot lose sight of the history and the reason behind, you know, things that are done. And, you know, one of the reasons behind the parade in Houston and in cities all around the world and festivals is the commemorance of Stonewall.
Exactly. And once again, must reading for any Queer Voices listener, Stonewall by David Carter.
Yes, absolutely.
If you want to know this true story and to understand the politics and the history of the time that created what became an annual celebration, and they do it in other cities at different times of the year for various reasons. Houston has always had the tradition of doing it in June,
which is the traditional Stonewall weekend.
Right, because it was June 28th of 1969. I think there was a full moon then.
Yes, I believe so. And I read that book cover to cover, and we interviewed David Carter.
Right,
too.
And I thought I was going to be, this is going to be so dry about this, that, and it was fascinating.
And it was, and David basically spent 10 years researching this topic.
And especially since he was able to go back from something that the 40th anniversary will be coming up in 2009. Ooh, that's going to be some party. So anyway, let's say thanks to the people that have worked and throughout the years making the parade possible, making the festival and other events possible. Let's ask each of our organizations to step up, be part of the solution, not part of the problem, and let's move on and see what we can do in 2008, which is the 30th anniversary of the Houston celebration. And if you want more information about Pride Houston, the best place to go is www.pridehouston.org.
And we will go now to This Way Out, and then we'll come before the end of the hour. We'll do some announcements and calendar events as things are coming up here in Houston. But let's give this a try. And, you know, since I'm the substitute Glenn here,
yeah,
I don't quite know all the bells and whistles here like he does.
And make sure you stay tuned in our second hour for Queer Music Heritage.
When you understand what real equality is, you understand that people who love each other must have the opportunity to be able to express that. The state should not be intervening against people. The state should be there on behalf of people.
What is at the heart of your opposition to same-sex marriage?
Well, Joe, I prefer to think of it as being very positive about civil unions.
Welcome to This Way Out, the International Gay and Lesbian Radio Magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. A gay Canadian MP ties the knot, but a civil union announcement irks Anglicans. Queers hit the streets in Japan and Bulgaria, and on the record with Clinton and Kucinich. Those stories and more this week because you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm John Beaupre.
And I'm Rick Watts.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending August 25th, 2007. Openly gay Liberal Canadian Member of Parliament Scott Risson and his partner Maxime St-Pierre got married on August 18th in Chevrerie, Nova Scotia, a town of about 200 people on the province's western shoreline. The event was prominently reported across the country. He's the first lesbi-gay federal politician to wed since Canada established marriage equality nationwide in 2005, and after eight provinces and one territory had legalized it on their own. Risson, who came out in 2002, has repeatedly said that he is not a gay politician, but a politician who happens to be gay. Prior to the ceremony, his spokesman told the Canadian Press Wire Service that the wedding was a personal matter that is meant to be celebrated in private. Prominent Canadians reportedly in attendance included former Prime Ministers Paul Martin and Joe Clark, Liberal Party leader Stéphane Dion, former Defense Minister Bill Graham, former New Brunswick Premier Frank McKenna, and former Ontario Premier Bob Rae.
New Hampshire Episcopal Bishop Gene Robinson, the only openly gay bishop in the worldwide Anglican Communion, discussed plans for a civil union with his partner of 18 years, Mark Andrew, soon after they become legal in his state on January 1st, during an interview this week with the British Broadcasting Corporation. His comments prompted an attack by Anglican conservatives, who called them a publicity stunt. Nigerian Archbishop Peter Akinola, the most outspokenly anti-queer voice in the communion, has repeatedly condemned Robinson's consecration. He issued a statement this week saying that theological conservatives cannot stand by as the Episcopal Church, the Anglican body in the U.S. and some regions of the Anglican Church of Canada, also support the blessing of same-gender relationships. We earnestly desire the healing of our beloved communion, Akinola wrote, but not at the cost of rewriting the Bible to accommodate the latest cultural trend. Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams, the titular leader of the worldwide denomination, has been trying to keep the church from splintering over lesbi-gay issues. While Robinson will be allowed to attend the upcoming Lambeth Conference, a once-a-decade meeting of the world's Anglican bishops, Williams won't allow him to participate or vote. A similar restriction has been placed on bishops from breakaway conservative U.S. Episcopal churches who've aligned with and been consecrated by Akinola. The steering committee for the Global South Primates, representing almost half of the denomination's 77 million members and in its most conservative regions, mainly in Africa, Latin America, and Asia, said last month that its bishops will boycott Lambeth because the Episcopal Church is being allowed to participate. Akinola's statement also referenced a seemingly inevitable schism in the Anglican Communion by saying that the moment of decision is almost upon us.
A Presbyterian Church USA court has reversed a lower judicial body and ruled that the Reverend Jane Sparr violated church doctrine when she officiated at the unions of two lesbian couples in 2004 and 2005. The denomination's highest court in 2000 said that Presbyterian ministers can bless same-gender unions as long as they don't equate the relationships with marriage and the ceremonies don't mimic traditional weddings. Sparr had testified to performing hundreds of weddings during her career, saying that she called it marriage if that was the term a couple preferred. A lower church court last year decided that Sparr acted within her rights as an ordained minister, but conservatives appealed the ruling to the higher body, which ruled this week that even though Sparr had acted with conscience and conviction, her actions were contrary to the Presbyterian Church USA Constitution, as it is authoritatively interpreted. A minister for more than 30 years, Spahr came out as a lesbian in 1978. She's now retired. In a statement following the ruling, Spahr said that she was deeply saddened that our church has chosen not to recognize the loving relationships of members of its own family. This reversal of the Presbytery's decision promotes a belief that somehow this love is less than valid. She has about a month to appeal the decision to the General Assembly Permanent Judicial Commission.
Christian groups from the Interfaith Coalition Against Homosexuality held a protest rally in Kampala this week to condemn last week's first-ever press conference by LGBT activists in Uganda, during which they demanded their civil rights. About 100 protesters carried dozens of placards saying, "Arrest all homos. Homosexuality and lesbianism break three laws," protest organizer and pastor Martin Seppa told reporters. "The laws in the Bible and the Quran, the laws of nature and the laws of the land. The African nation punishes sodomy with life in prison." But Paul Kagaba, a member of Sexual Minorities Uganda, told the Reuters news service that, "We did not hold a press conference against churches and government. We were simply telling everyone to leave us alone." The global civil liberties group Human Rights Watch this week issued a letter to rabidly anti-queer Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni, asking that his government stop promoting state homophobia. In a separate statement, the group accused Museveni's government, in power since 1986, of harassing LGBT organizations, promoting discrimination through state media, and raiding the homes of activists. There was no immediate response from the Ugandan government.
Politicians on two other continents are in hot water over their homophobic remarks. The most egregious came from Giancarlo Gentilini, the right-wing deputy mayor of the northern Italian city of Treviso, who said he's ordering his police force to carry out ethnic cleansing of faggots. Gentilini said he's sick of gays meeting up and having sex in a local parking lot. "The faggots must go to other cities where they are welcome," he told a local television station. "Here in Treviso, there is no chance for faggots or the like." A video clip of the outburst was posted on YouTube. More than 1,000 queer and queer-supportive demonstrators picketed City Hall to demand Gentilini's immediate resignation. Many in the crowd wore pink triangles, the symbol gays were forced to wear in Nazi concentration camps. Politicians from several parties across the country also denounced the remarks, and prosecutors have said they'll investigate whether Gentilini's language violated criminal law.
And in the U.S., the mayor of Fort Lauderdale, Florida, has been complaining about what he sees as a problem of gay cruising along the city's beach. Mayor Jim Nagle has charged that gay sex is rampant in public washrooms on the beach and called for the city to spend $250,000 on new tech replacement toilets that he said would end the problem. Police officials said there is no such problem, but Nagle then claimed that Broward County has the highest rate of new HIV/AIDS cases in the country involving men having sex with men, and suggested that local tourism officials should rethink their ad campaigns that welcome lesbian gay people to the area. But the Sun Sentinel newspaper reported this week that the Greater Fort Lauderdale Convention and Visitors Board has asked Nagle to stop his hurtful, mean-spirited rhetoric, while county commissioners have drafted a measure to oust the mayor from his seat on the tourism board. Infuriated locals have also launched a Flush Nagle campaign.
In other news, about 3,000 people marched in Tokyo's 6th Pride Parade on August 11th. The procession through the Shibuya and Harajuku neighborhoods featured floats, a marching band, rainbow balloons and flags, and marchers wearing G-strings and feather boas. Organizers said they hope to create a climate where fewer LGBT people live in fear of coming out. Events in a park attracted about 5,000 celebrants for seminars, speeches, a flea market, food, live music, and dancing.
Members of the Bulgarian gay organization Gemini gather the same day in Sofia's Octavius Park to distribute brochures on lesbi-gay issues and HIV prevention to the general public. The Pink Point Project aims to correct misconceptions about LGBT people, according to Gemini leader Aksinia Gencheva, and to deliver accurate and fair information. The group has also been handing out condoms and safe sex information at gay bars.
But finally, a group of fundamentalist Christian youth rioted last week in the Swedish city of Jönköping. Police battled about 30 protesters after they torched a poster promoting a celebrated photo mural exhibit in their city that portrays Jesus as gay. Ecce Homo by Elizabeth Olsen Wallen, a former photojournalist and out lesbian, portrays Christ's teaching and passion in the context of late 20th century gay life. Ecce Homo, or Behold the Man, were Pontius Pilate's words, according to the New Testament, as he presented Jesus to the angry mob before the crucifixion. The collection premiered in Wallin's native Stockholm in 1998, where she was often given police protection after receiving several death threats. The most controversial image, a well-endowed nude Jesus being baptized by an appreciative John the Baptist in a backlit swimming pool, led the European Parliament to cancel its tour of the series. The renewed interest in Ecce Homo was prompted by an American art historian named Cherry, who features the images in her new book, Art That Dares, Gay Jesus, Women Christ, and More. She told Gay.com that Wallin is now starting to get hate mail from the United States, even though Ecce Homo has never been exhibited there. The violence is showing the need for artwork such as this, Cherry said. So often it's Christians versus gays, when in fact Jesus taught love toward everybody.
Best News Wrap for the week ending August 25th, 2007. Written by Greg Gordon and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area. An informed community is a strong community. For This Way Out, I'm John Beaupre.
And I'm Rick Watts.
We'll run another lap of the U.S. presidential race, but first, no one is faster on his feet than one of our favorite elected representatives.
Barney Frank, quick-witted congressman, coming up now on the Rainbow Minute. Born in 1940, Barney Frank graduated from Harvard, then worked for elected officials in Massachusetts. His own political career began in 1972 when elected to the Massachusetts House. 8 years later, he was elected to the U.S. House of Representatives. A master of debate, he became a champion of liberalism, winning re-election time after time. Barney came out in 1987 amid overwhelming support from constituents. While devoted to causes like fair housing and consumer rights, he's an unflappable leader on GLBT issues. Barney once said, quote, "Remember how far we've come toward the goal of equality, as well as how far we have to go to reach it. Both are essential if we're to get there." The Rainbow Minute is produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns and recorded in the studios of WRIR in Richmond, Virginia, and read by volunteers like me, Virginia State Delegate Adam Eben.
LGBT visibility in the U.S. political process was raised to a new level with the historic presidential candidate forum hosted by the Human Rights Campaign and televised live by the Logo cable television channel. The two-hour event featured individual appearances by six Democratic contenders for the White House. In the first two parts of This Way Out's coverage of the forum, we've excerpted the remarks of New Mexico Governor Bill Richardson and Senators Mike Gravel, John Edwards, and Barack Obama. There are two more candidates to be heard from. He's considered a long shot for his party's nomination, but Ohio Congressman Dennis Kucinich would be a sure bet for LGBT rights. That fact was well recognized by panelists Jonathan Capehart of the Washington Post, lesbian rock icon Melissa Etheridge, and HRC Executive Director Joel Salmanese when Kucinich was welcomed to the stage by moderator Margaret Coulson of Bloomberg News.
Congressman,
how you doing?
See you. Good.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Thanks. Have a seat.
You bet.
Jonathan, would you begin?
Congressman Kucinich, you're seemingly for everything the gay community wants. I took a look at your HRC questionnaire. Support, 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 support. So is there anything that the LGBT community
wait, finish your question.
Is there anything that the LGBT community wants that you're against? There's got to be some.
All I can say is keep those contributions coming. You have and you'll have the president that you want.
I'll take that as a no.
That's a no.
Right. So you're one of just two candidates who fully supports same-sex marriage. Why do you think that is?
Well, I can tell you from my own experience. I mean, this is really a question of whether you really believe in equality. I mean, I see the equal sign there, and I have that same sign in my office in Washington, D.C. And imagine that equal sign inside a heart. Because what we're really talking about here is human love. And there's no power on this earth greater than human love. And when you understand what real equality is, you understand that people who love each other must have the opportunity to be able to express that in a way that is meaningful, and that the state should not be intervening against people. The state should be there on behalf of people to make sure that love has a chance to be facilitated. So to me,
Would it be very easy for me as President of the United States to issue executive orders that will require all federal contractors, anyone who's doing business with the federal government anyway, every federal agency, to have to follow the principles that are written in ENDA and to let the federal government be the agent of change that it should be, and then to lead the way as President of the United States in bringing about the kind of unity that shows that real unity is to respect each other's inequality, and real unity is to respect the power of human love. The greatest commandment is love. And I think that if someone embodies that and lives it, then things change in a country. That's, love has that transformative power. And that's what I have always tried to bring into public forums. And that's what I'll bring into the White House as well. Every one of us, through taking a stand, has the potential to help any one of us evolve. That's the gift we give to each other. And when someone is President of the United States and is willing to share that with the nation, we can help lift up the whole nation in so many ways, not only in matters of equality, but in matters of peace, in matters of all social and economic justice. I mean, that's what I'm about. So to be here is an honor, because I recognize the journey of so many people in this room, of solitary journeys of courage, real courage. And when you understand that, then of course, as president, I want to exemplify that, because so many of you have already taken that path, yes. And you deserve a leader who's ready to take the same path.
Congressman, you're further out than most, many people, I mean most Democrats. And I'm wondering, how are you going to get elected president?
Well, let me tell you why I am the candidate right in the center of the aspirations of the American people's hopes and dreams. I led the effort in the House of Representatives 5 years ago in challenging the administration's march towards war against Iraq. No other candidate in this race can say that, nor can they say that they voted against the war and or voted against funding for the war consistently. The rest of the country's come in my direction on that. I took the stand when it was really unpopular to do so. Being President of the United States means that you have to do the right thing the first time. And it means that when you're talking about civil liberties, marriage equality, employment non-discrimination, when you're talking about standing for people's rights to be who they are without fear of being attacked, you're talking about something that is really essentially American. And so I'm at the center of all of those discussions. And my candidacy for president is not only transforming the race, but I want you to understand how it will transform this nation when you have a president who cannot be bought or bossed, who has the willingness to stand up and speak out when others would be silent, who can challenge war, who can challenge corruption, because my heart is clean, because I have the ability to see and pierce that veil of a falsehood which covers so much of our country today. I see the world as one, Margaret. I see the world as being interconnected and interdependent. Anything that separates any of us needs to be looked at, and we need to find ways of discussing the imperative of human unity, but not just discussing it. It's one thing to talk about it. It's another thing to act from that understanding and awareness. And that's what I'm prepared to do as the next president of the United States, elected in 2008.
Kucinich was not fazed by mention of his low poll showings in this, his second campaign for the presidency, especially since it took 5 runs before he won his congressional seat. Hillary Clinton is, by most accounts, at the front of the Democratic pack, and she was the final candidate to face the forum.
Senator Clinton, welcome.
Thank you.
Joe is our first questioner for you, Senator.
You've said in past settings like this and in all across the country that you would like to repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Now, since 2003, you've sat on the Senate Armed Services Committee, the committee that would decide this issue. Why haven't you introduced legislation to repeal this policy?
I think the very simple answer is we didn't have a chance with the Republican Congress and George Bush as president. And I want to get it done when I'm president. I want to do it and have it be successful. We're talking now that we have a Democratic Congress about what steps we can take to sort of lay the groundwork so that when we do have a change in the White House, which can't happen too soon to suit me, we will... We will be able to move on that. But I just want to sort of put it into a broader context because it was a transitional action that was taken back at the beginning of my husband's administration because at the time there was such a witch hunt going on. And, you know, we have moved a long way on this and other issues, but I think it's important to recall how much of an advance don't ask, don't tell was at the time. However, it was not implemented appropriately. It was still used to discharge a lot of patriotic men and women who were serving our country, often at great cost in the middle of a war where people were being told, we don't need your services anymore, including, you know, linguists and translators and other specialty services. Judge people on conduct, not status. No matter whether you're, you know, gay or straight, that's the way it should be. It should be even-handed across the entire services.
Talk to us about what is at the heart of your opposition to same-sex marriage.
Well, Joe, I prefer to think of it as being very positive about civil unions. you know, it's a personal position, and... You know, for me, we have made it very clear in our country that we believe in equality. How we get to full equality is the debate we're having. And I am absolutely in favor of civil unions with full equality. And I've also been a very strong supporter of letting the states maintain their jurisdiction over marriage. And I believe that was the right decision for a lot of reasons. Because it's easy, again, to forget that just 2.5 years ago, we were facing all of these referenda that were enshrining discrimination in state constitutions. Now, 2.5 years later, we're beginning to see other states take different approaches. I want to proceed with equalizing federal benefits. I want to repeal Section 3 of DOMA, which stands in the way of the extension of benefits to people in committed same-sex relationships. And, you know, I will be very strongly in favor of doing that as president.
In the civil rights struggle, this argument that it was a states' rights issue was something that was typically used as sort of a red herring. And so can you see where this argument as marriage as a states' rights issue would resonate the same way in our community?
Absolutely. And, you know, Joe, not only that, I really respect the advocacy that the community is waging on behalf of marriage. I think you're doing exactly what you need to do and should do. But this has not been a long-term struggle yet. And I think it's really clear that, you know, people in the states are moving much more rapidly to deal with the inequalities than you would find at the federal level. When you and I were plotting strategy to beat the federal marriage amendment, the reason we were plotting strategy is we were worried it was going to pass. And we were able to defeat it. But I don't know that we could have defeated it if we had not had DOMA. I mean, that is something that, you know, has provided a great protection against what was clearly the Republican strategy, blessed by George Bush, led by the congressional Republicans, to just cynically use marriage as a political tool.
Jonathan.
Real fast, Senator. Joint Chiefs Chairman, former Joint Chiefs Chairman Peter Pace called homosexuality immoral. And when you were first asked about it, you said, quote, I'm going to leave that to others to conclude. The next day, after much criticism, you finally said you did not think that homosexuality was immoral. Why didn't you say that the first time?
Well, it was a mistake, Jonathan, because what I went on to say after what you quoted was to launch an attack on Don't Ask, Don't Tell, you know, because my view was that as a chairman of the Joint Chiefs, he had absolutely no right to say what he said. I disagreed with him profoundly. But what was really offensive is that he was in a position of responsibility that had a direct impact on the lives of, you know, hundreds of thousands of these young people in the military. So I went right at him on Don't Ask, Don't Tell. You know, you say these things, you know, somebody sticks a microphone in front of you, and I thought, well, that's, you know, that's pretty good. And then my friends started calling me and saying, well, yeah, that wasn't very good. So I said, you know, oh, you're probably right. So I immediately got the first opportunity I could to, you know, say the whole thing. But I come to these issues, you know, not as a senator or as a lawyer or as a presidential candidate, but as a friend of a lot of members of the LGBT community who have, who are my age, who have suffered through a long period of, you know, coming out, of having to face families, of having to deal with all of the issues that we know occur. And I want to be a president who can clearly say to the American people, you know, these are our friends, our children, our parents. These are people who we want to support as they live the best lives they can. So it's very personal for me. And we are not going to agree on everything, but I will be a president who will fight for you, will work to end discrimination in the employment area, end Don't Ask, Don't Tell, finally get hate crimes through, do a lot of what we need to do on HIV, AIDS, and so much more. And I really hope that we can be partners in trying to make our country a little bit better and a little more progressive for all of us. Thank
Senator.
You.
Senator. Wish we had more time. Thank you.
That was Senator Hillary Clinton speaking at the first U.S. Presidential Forum on LGBT issues, sponsored by the Human Rights Campaign and televised nationally and webcast by Logo TV. Two other major Democratic candidates, Senators Joe Biden and Chris Dodd, said they were unable to attend the forum due to scheduling conflicts. Republican candidates were invited to participate, but all either declined or ignored the challenge. The forum was covered with great interest in the mainstream media and received kudos from most corners. In addition to his congratulations, National Gay and Lesbian Task Force Executive Director Matt Forman noted that in the past, Democratic candidates had offered similar proclamations of support, almost always to queer audiences. He challenged the contenders to step from behind the lavender curtain and consistently, unapologetically speak for our fundamental humanity everywhere they go. Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the International Lesbian and Gay Radio Magazine. This week, John Beaupre, Rick Watts, Rex Watner with Bill Kelly, Graham Underhill, and Judd Proctor and Brian Burns with Adam Evan contributed program material. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. Listen online to This Way Out anytime and exclusively at outinamerica.com. You can also get there by clicking on the link at the top of our website, thiswayout.org. Some This Way Out operating expenses are supported by direct tax-deductible donations from our listeners. Thank you. Please log on to thiswayout.org to see how you can help keep this program on the air. You can also subscribe to CDs or cassettes of our weekly programs there. To contact us online, you can also email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and the entire This Way Out family, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening on CJMP, Powell River, British Columbia, WTND, Macon, Illinois, KSOW, Cottage Grove, Oregon, and more than 150 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Everybody, we're going to stay tuned.
And, of course, this radio station is KPFT Houston, and we are a proud supporter of this program called This Way Out. And we've been lucky enough to have it on the show ever since Queer Voices, or the previous Lesbian and Gay Voices, premiered in 1993.
Wow. And, of course, our very own J.D. Doyle contributes to This Way Out with audiophile. Part of the Pacifica family, and we want to remind you to continue to support KPFT and Pacifica financially and with your volunteer time. In fact, we make a special invitation to people to join us to add your voice to Queer Voices. And there's a variety of ways you can do that. Everything from coming in and helping to answer phones and escorting guests in and out of the studio to helping schedule guests. Maybe you want to do a book review. Maybe you have a particular topic such as health that you want to talk about, bring people on to discuss.
Or maybe you want a valet park, or...
Hey, now that's a good idea. Or you want to do security.
Right. Maybe you have some other skills like web design.
Oh, yes. We very much would welcome a web designer and someone who's willing to teach web design. KPFT itself does hold training sessions, and you can learn how to engineer. We certainly need more engineers to be able to be on our show and take part in it. You don't have to necessarily devote a lot of time to the program. Maybe you just want to do a segment once a month, and that's fine. We particularly would like to invite people that are, I started to say under the age of 30, but let's face it, under the age of 40 would be nice. Because
except
we're veterans.
Except us who are almost in our wheelchairs, right?
Yes, and then we also particularly would like to invite other women and people of color, because we do make sure that we have diversity on this program with our guests and with the topics. But and we have a lot coming up in September and October in our community, including the Q Fest, the
yes.
Gay and Lesbian Film Festival.
From what we know, it's going to be starting on September 20th and going through like the 24th. And their website, unfortunately, is not very updated. And they don't have any listings of the film yet. But their website is q-fest.org.
Well, we'll get, and my mind just blanked out on his name.
Christian Sanders.
Thank you. No, that's not right.
Isn't that it?
No. That's not right. Wait a minute. Kristen Salinas.
Oh, okay.
Salinas, who's the executive director of QFest. We'll be getting him on as soon as we can to update about that. Then October, we have the Sing for the Cure, which is the combined choruses of the Gay Men's Chorus and the Bayou City Women's Chorus. It's a special fundraiser for Susan G. Komen Foundation, and we're going to be having them on Queer Voices to talk about that, and also the Race for the Cure that comes up in the same month of October.
Decadent Desserts is in October. I believe it's October 6th.
Oh, gosh, my mouth is watering already. Yes, a sister's fundraiser, Decadent Dessert, something most of us in the community look forward to. And it will be the Houston Women's Festival, October 20th at Jones Plaza, and we're going to be featuring some of the artists that are going to be part of the festival, and Ruthie Foster, who is just phenomenal, is one of she's the headliner, that's the word, Deborah, for the festival. And if you haven't heard Ruthie, it's time that you did. So lots of things coming up. What particularly is coming up next week, Jack?
What particularly is coming up next week? And I don't have my cue cards in front of me. Next week, of course, it's David Elliott, because it's the first week. This Way Out, and Kelly Smith talks to Jennifer about...
We don't know
but
the topic is something that Kelly Smith, who's just this incredible motivational speaker, that's something she's doing with the GLBT community. And then we will talk to the organizers of the new Women's Night that is being held on the first Wednesday of every month at 1415 California. And there's been a Wednesday night gathering at one bar or another over many years. I don't know why it has to be the first Wednesday of the month. It annoys me because that's the night the Houston Gay and Lesbian Transgender Bisexual Political Caucus meets. But they're looking to do this a little different this time, and they're making it a real networking and community event. So if you want to buy tickets to Decadent Dessert, if you want to find out about community organizations, etc., it would be a good thing. So we'll be talking to them, and so we hope that you will join us on Queer Voices next Monday, September 3rd, and stay tuned for J.D. Doyle's Queer Music Heritage.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT Houston. Now, more of Queer Voices with Jack Walensky and the entire Queer Voices crew.
With a spike. We dress up and go out when he comes to visit. Some people stare and say, "What is it?" Uncle Mike is different, but that's all right with me. I just know that I love him. I hope you agree. Sometimes Mike likes to be called Michelle. We talk about my problems and he says, "Do tell." He really listens to what I have to say. We talk and talk and talk and talk and talk the whole day. It's what he's supposed to be. It's a little confusing, but I'm trying to understand what happens when Uncle Mike is no longer a man. But one thing that I know for real is how it's gonna make him feel. It's so instead of an uncle, I'll have an aunt. I have an uncle named Mike. He's a funny guy you'd really like. He wears women's clothes and he powders his nose. And he wears high heels with a spike. Up and go out when he comes to visit. Some people stare and say, "What is it?" Uncle Mike is different, but that's all right with me. I just know that I love him. I hope you agree.
Welcome to Queer Voices on KPFT, and this segment is called Queer Music Heritage. I'm J.D. Doyle, and this month I'm bringing you part 4 of my latest series on the music of transgendered artists, and it will include a very special interview. Now, if that song I used to start out the show sounded to you like a children's song, well, it is. In 2005, Susie Nash released an album called Rainbow Sprinkles. Its subtitle was Songs for Our Children, Celebrating Our Diverse Lives, and it was designed to empower the children of GLBT families. I think I've got a very interesting feature interview for you for this show with jazz musician Jennifer Lightham, who's been making great music on her stand-up bass since the late 70s. Before we get to that, I want to bring you some other transgendered artists. And first up is Ray Spoon. He's a Canadian artist with 3 CDs out now, and I'm sharing a track from his 2005 CD called Your Trailer Door. The song is called Don't Turn On Me.
Honey, I ain't got no reason to believe. Honey, I ain't got no reason to believe. You'll never turn my way. You'll ever turn my way. It's the biggest little problem in the world.
Is a track from another new recording, and while the artist is not transgendered, the subject matter is. Jeff Heiskell was the leading force behind the band The Judy Bats, who had a number of releases starting in the early 1990s. He's now fronting a new band, just called Heiskell, and I find the song you'll hear very intriguing. It follows his observations of a young boy and the boy's journey to become an Atlanta drag queen and future transsexual known as The Death of Knoxville Cool.
Trolling in the park today, I spy a little boy so fair.
mother's misty eyes meet mine. This instance where we both divide.
Again, that was the band High School from their new album, Soundtrack for an Aneurysm. I've been a fan of this next artist since her 1997 album, All I Want, and on my November 2005 show, I featured a wonderful interview with her. She's Veronica Klaus, and she recently sent me an advanced copy of an album by her called Family Jewels, The Making of Veronica Klaus. That's the title of her award-winning show in San Francisco, and is her story set to music connected with dialogue. I'm very pleased to share with you a little bit of it. Veronica Klaus.
Well, you might as well know, I wasn't always Veronica. I had another name, but it was never really mine. At least I never felt like it was. It was something, well, just another thing I was called. I'd tell you that name, but then you'd save it in your head and hear it whispered in your ear every time you looked at me. I don't need that. This is no illusion. If I told you that other name, you'd be tempted to think that that other person was who I really am, when in fact, that other person was much more of an illusion. When I had first started to sing in San Francisco, to put together a band and become comfortable in my own skin, Veronica's skin, I met a musician who was intrigued by me, intrigued enough to come to my boudoir, but nervous enough to need too many cocktails to do it. At one point in the evening, after sex and before he asked me for money, saxophone players have no shame. He gave me a tape of an obscure Nina Simone song, suggesting it was the perfect song for me to sing. I politely said, "Thank you," and gave him $20. Some people reach for the stars. Others may end up behind bars. What the future has in store. Find that key to success.
tomorrow is my turn. No more doubts, no more fears. Tomorrow is my turn. When my luck is returning, all these years I've been learning to save fingers from burning. Tomorrow is my turn. No more doubts, no more fears. Tomorrow is my turn to receive without giving, to make life worth a living. Now it's my life I'm living. My only concern for tomorrow is my turn. Whenever summer is gone, there's another to come. You can't stop the years from drifting. Tomorrow is my turn. No more doubts, no more fears. Tomorrow is my turn to receive without giving, to make life worth the living. Now it's my life I'm living. My only concern for tomorrow is my.
People ask me if I feel like a woman. They talk about having the best of both worlds, or assume that I must have some sort of divine knowledge or acute insight into what makes men and women tick, having, as they see it, seen both sides. The truth is, I feel a little badly not being able to give them that key. You see, having lived this life has not given me any insight into men and women that would sell books or get me on Oprah. Do I feel like a woman? The truth is, I have no idea if I feel like any other woman or not. I have no idea if I ever felt like any other man. All I know is that I feel like me, Veronica.
Short excerpt definitely does not do justice to Veronica Klaus's show. If you can't make it to San Francisco to see her, you'll just have to get the whole album to experience it. Again, that was from Family Jewels, The Making of Veronica Clouse.
Hello, this is Veronica Clouse, and you're listening to Queer Music Heritage.
You can find out more about her at www.veronicaclouse.com.
The homosexual, it is true, at times does adopt the clothing or the makeup of a woman to lure members of his own sex. But this is not so for the transvestite. The transvestite is not interested in those of their own sex. The clothing is not worn to attract the attention of their own sex, but to eliminate themselves from being a member of that sex. Then comes the major surgery, the removal of the man and the formation of the woman. A woman born at the age of 24.
A new life is begun.
The body of the woman within begins to appear now. The world is shocked by a person who changed his sex. Thus, the strange case of Glenn, who was Glenda, one and the same person, not half man, half woman, but nevertheless, man and woman in the same body. He dares to enter the street dressed in the clothes he so much desires to wear.
Glenn is engaged to be married to Barbara. Glenn's problem is a deep one, but he must tell her soon. She's begun to notice things. Soon she will realize. He learned that foreign doctors were doing marvelous work with a sex change. Man to woman, woman to man.
Glenda has made the decision.
If the newspapers had not gotten hold of the story, it would have gone untold, unnoticed as so many others in medical history.
Why is the modern world shocked by this headline? Why?
Do you realize what would happen if every man in the country that wanted to wear women's clothes or felt like a woman went to their doctors and wanted a sex change?
Glenn and all the hundreds of thousands of other Glens across the nation face quite a problem.
So goes part of the trailer for the schlocky 1953 movie, Glenn or Glenda, directed by and starring Ed Wood. We've come a long way, and this is a good time to invite you to check out my website. If you visit while you're listening, you can see the playlist and follow along while looking at photos of the artists and recordings. I've always considered our music history as a visual as well as an audio experience. Again, that's at www.queermusicheritage.com. Also, for more very queer programming, please listen to my friend Jimmy Carper and his show After Hours every Friday night, Saturday morning from 1 to 4 a.m. on KPFT. It's queer radio with attitude. Okay, pay attention not to the singer on this next song, but the bass player.
Glow, little glowworm, glimmer, glimmer. Fly through the wintry night, little swimmer. Let not the neon make you duller. Sparkle and shine in technicolor. Although the thought may still be rankling, you made the scene before Ben Franklin. Rev up your ramps and let her go. Glow, little glowworm, glow.
Now, why on earth would I be playing Glowworm by Mel Torme on Queer Music Heritage? Well, again, I'm not really focusing on Mel, but on the bass player who worked with him for 10 years. That's jazz musician Jennifer Lightham, who before 2002 was John Lightham. Since 1979, this artist has performed with a who's who of the jazz world, from Woody Herman, George Shearing, Doc Severinsen, Peggy Lee, Cleo Lane, and on. You've got to be pretty talented to work for that long in those circles. Her very public transition was difficult enough without also facing the unknown reception she would get in the less-than-liberal jazz world. That hasn't slowed her down, though, as she just released her sixth album, and that's where I started my interview with Jennifer Lightham. Tell me about the album The Real Me.
Well, The Real Me is my sixth CD. It's the first one to bear my true identity, Jennifer Lightham, and I'm very proud of it. It's all original music. It's got a couple of vocals on it, but it's mostly accessible jazz. It's jazz that people that like rock or classical or folk music, they all seem to like this record, and again, I'm very proud of it.
One review I've read says that you've earned the reputation as a swinging, straight-ahead player. What does that expression mean?
Well, I guess the more famous people that I've played with have been people like Mel Torme and Doc Severinsen. And in playing their style of music, I have to pretty much play a very classic approach to playing the string bass, and you know, the quarter note right down the middle of the beat, and play driving bass lines, and that I guess would be a straight ahead swinging kind of player. And I've always been blessed with a very good sense of time, and I've worked really hard at that, so where that my bass never wavers. I never slow down or speed up, you know. I'm pretty consistent with that. And it makes me popular amongst those people that you know, want a real solid support from the bass player. I feel like I do a lot more than just that, but that one particular quote is attributed about me.
From reading about you, I've noticed that with your music, you do at least three things out of the ordinary. You're a woman playing an upright bass, you play lead or melody, and you play left-handed.
Yes to all three. I think it all stems from my being, who I am. I chose to play the bass basically because it just felt like it was right. It felt like it was part of me. And I just did it my way right from the beginning, and I've tried to live my life that way too, just be who I am. And it's taken a long time, but I'm finally able to express all of me. And it's always come through the bass, and I'm playing left-handed is unusual because it's difficult to find an instrument that is proper for a left-handed player on the string bass, because not only do the strings have to be reversed, but the entire bass has to be taken apart and rebuilt so that it resonates properly. So it, for a left-handed player who strings it left-handed, the E string has to be on the opposite side, the A string, and so forth. And so it's almost like the bass goes through a reassignment, almost like I did in my surgery. The bass went through, reassignment surgery as well.
I don't want to get too far into this interview without touching on particular songs, so I'll ease into that this way. You've released 6 albums since 1989. Which one brought you the most attention, and any idea why?
Oh, good question. The second and third one, the second one was the Southpaw, and I had a really wonderful bunch of musicians on that with me, but it was probably the last studio record for Bob Cooper. He was a tenor saxophone player that played with Stan Kenton's band, was married to June Christie. He was a great man. He was like a father figure to me. And it was his last recording, I think, studio recording, and that record has sort of become a collector's item because of that. Mm-hmm. And some of my compositions from that record, I started to get noticed for my songwriting on that record. There was a tune I wrote in there called Turkish Bazaar, and another one, Stick It In Your Ear. And I re-recorded those tunes on The Real Me. And part of the reason is some of those older records, like the following record after that was Lefty Leaps In, and one of the tunes from that record, the Studio City Stomp, is probably the most popular song that I've ever written. It's gotten a lot of play around the world, and it's actually a hit tune in Norway. And it's been in a number of television shows and things. It's quite a popular song for me. And I've re-recorded that one as well on The Real Me. Partially because I took some of my more popular music, re-recorded it under my proper identity. So now when radio people want to play my songs, they can play them and not have to be fumbling on the name. They can say the right name.
Right. So Studio City Stomp is perhaps your best known track?
I would say so, yeah. Of all the things I've written, yeah.
Here's a little of Studio City Stomp. That song was originally on the 1996 album Lefty Leaps In, but this version came from the new release, The Real Me. You've performed with a who's who of notables, including Mel Torme, George Shearing, Peggy Lee, Doc Severinsen, Jerry Mulligan. That's pretty amazing success. Looking back on those years, does anything stand out to you as a crowning moment?
Oh my goodness, there are many. There were several with Mel Torme that just I'll never forget. One of them was playing the Bumper Shoot Festival in Seattle, which was quite an exciting venue. It was a giant arena with, it was filled with about 55,000 people. And the Bumper Shoot Festival is interesting in that there's all kinds of music happening on the same stage. And so it's not just jazz acts on the big stage. We were the opening act for the Ramones and Mudhoney. And in a, you know, it was a Mel Torme, you know, and it was right about the time when he had done the Mountain Dew commercial and MTV was paying attention to Mel and I'd been on a Night Court show with him and he was riding a wave of popularity. The people just went crazy for us. I felt like a rock star. It was about the time when mosh pits were a big thing and crowd diving and everything. And all of that was going on while we were singing Stardust, you know. And it was really quite an interesting experience. That was a high point. Also, the first time we played Carnegie Hall with Mel was quite an exciting experience. I played there 10 times with him. And it was always like you got goosebumps just being backstage and knowing the history of the place you were in and having the, you know, being called to perform on that stage where all these amazing historical concerts took place. That was a big thrill.
Have you done much television?
Yeah, I've done a fair amount. I mean, with Doc, I did a number of, Doc Severinsen, we did a number of TV things. I was on The Tonight Show one time. I was on a lot of PBS specials with Mel. The last television thing that Mel did, it was a week before he had a stroke, was for the Arts and Entertainment Channel. But that was one of them. I've been on a number of shows.
In recent years, you've gone from playing with other bands to having your own trio. Could you tell us about that?
Well, I've always kept a group. I was leading groups back in the 80s, but after transitioning, I was in a kind of a state where the jazz community, per se, wasn't calling me. I was being totally avoided, and I was at one time going to give up. I wasn't even going to play music anymore, but I just couldn't go without playing music. It's just who I am. And leading my own band has been sort of my salvation as far as putting it out there that I'm still a capable player and I'm a fairly well-adjusted human being, you know. And I think it's broken down a lot of the walls that people put up after I transitioned. Wherever I get booked, like when we're booked at, you know, your normal type jazz festivals with all of, you know, your average type people around, people dig the music, and that's what it's about.
On your new album is a track called The Altered Blues. Could you tell me about that one?
Oh, that one is a deep one. That I wrote that song for my surgeon. His name's Dr. Alter. And I wrote a song that tries to deal musically with the subject of the gender dysphoria or gender identity disorder, whatever the medical profession wants to call it. This notion of having something in your brain that just will not go away. You don't want it there. Nobody asked for it. But it won't go away. And, I mean, the whole key to dealing with it and having a decent enough life is to learn how to make music with it. And I try to do that musically through the Altered Blues, where there are these two notes, D and G. And it's like, oh, they're just notes that just are in every chord, and they won't go away. And so the idea is to take those two notes and those chords, and the chords change all around, but those notes stay. And just try to make some kind of coherent musical beauty out of it. And it's a challenge. But I think we made it work.
Could you make maybe some more observations about the changes in the way people treated you after your surgery?
Well, the jazz world, you would think, would be a very creative environment. Like very artistic people who would be pretty open-minded, you would think. But unfortunately, the commercial jazz world is populated at the entrepreneurial level by very conservative people. And they just were not willing to give me a shake. Several of them fulfilled their contracts after I had transitioned, and they had already booked me for festivals and things. I fulfilled the contracts. I did the job competently. The audience seemed to really like what I did, but I wasn't asked back in a lot of cases. And so that's been very difficult. The jazz musician world, I kind of learned who my friends were, you know, who really was really my friends and really respected my musicianship, and those who were just shining me on. So it sort of weeded out a lot of the dead wood as far as my career goes. And I've formed new circles, and some of the old people from my previous existence are still in my career and in my life. But I made a new path. I got away from the negative people, who were pretty much shunning me, and I just didn't even try to win their approval. But gradually, the more I stick my nose out there, the better it's getting. If I shirk away from them, I let them win. You know, so I just sort of do what I do, and the more I show people that I'm okay with everything, then they become a little more okay with me.
You've had about 5 years to observe this. Do you think the jazz world in general is more accepting now than previously?
Well, I've created my own little corner of the jazz world. I by no means feel that I'm of an echelon that I can go out and book myself at major festivals yet. That's what my goal is someday, is to be an entity that can tour with my own group. I don't know that that's ever going to be possible, but whatever I'm going to do, I'm going to forge my own path, whether it's in the jazz world or whether it's in another kind of world. I don't know.
I imagine you had a lot of fears about the impact of your transitioning on your career.
Totally. Like I say, I was ready to walk away from a musical career. I didn't think that was going to be possible. It took me a long time to get over that fear that I was going to lose my career. It's one reason why it took me until I was 48 years old to transition. I was scared to death. I love to play music. It drives me more than anything. And I was afraid I was going to lose that. And it took me a long time to just be willing to face the fear and go through with it. And again, I was ready to walk away. I thought I would have to at one point, but leading my group, again, has been the thing that has kept my head up. And
it's probably empowering, too.
Quite. Because I can control what I say. I can control what I look like, you know. And it's really been a great forum for me.
Well, from your photos, you look pretty good.
Well, thank you. You should have seen me when I was a teenager.
Let's get to another song from your new album. I think Beat the Meatles is an inspired track. Could you tell me about that one?
I wrote that song on my computer. I wanted to do a tune on the Real Me that harkens back to my days in elementary school when I was a Beatle freak. But I just wanted to put a little tribute to the Beatles, so I took just snippets of Beatle melodies and Beatle background figures. And I started messing around. I'd write like a phrase, like a little bar phrase or a bar and a half phrase. And I would just like make a quilt out of it on the staff. I would put Beatle things underneath from other tunes and juxtapose melodies on the top staff. And I just kind of sewed together this quilt of Beatle stuff. And then I give it that title. Nonsense title, but it's fun.
What advice would you give other trans musicians?
Oh, boy. Well, as with everybody in life, all of us are so different. And it's hard to just lump us all together. There's so many different styles of music and so many different ways of approaching being a trans person. I never think of myself as a trans person. I don't know if that's the right thing to say or not, but I mean, it's certainly reminded of it all the time, but I'm just a person. And in approaching my music and my career, I'm a musician first. The music is what is important. My being transsexual is not, the major focus. It's not the thing I want to project as the main thing. Obviously, people are paying attention to me because of it. But the point I want to get across is that the music is my competence is far more important. And that's the thing I want to get out there more than anything, is the fact that I'm a competent musician. And anyone who's approaching a career in music as a trans person, you've got to be as strong a player and a strong individual and just put your best foot forward at all times. And of course, you're going to be judged for being a trans person, but if what you're putting out there as your art is not the strongest possible thing, you'll be like a wounded fish in the water, a bunch of hungry sharks, you know.
Since you're so out about your transition, do you have any feelings that at points you're an activist?
Oh, goodness. Well, I'm an activist in that I guess you could say maybe because I'm open, but there are so many people who are really true activists that go to lobby Congress and they take on court battles, and they're far more activists than I am. If I can be an activist in any way, it's just to prove the point that trans people are no different than anyone else. I don't ask for any special favors because I'm a trans person. I want people to think of me as a good musician, you know, and really good at what I do. That's far more important to me.
Good answers. I want to ask some questions about particular songs. Is there a song that seems to be the biggest crowd pleaser?
That's a good question. Well, Studio City Stomp is my big hit, you know, and people always react to that. But I think gradually I wrote this song a long time ago called Split Brain, and it's on my very first record. And at the time, my ex kind of labeled it Split Brain. And well, I was married to a woman for a long time. We were married close to 20 years. And she had a degree in experimental psychology. And this is back, we met back in 1980. And she thought that at the time that my problem was because I had a split brain. Like one side wasn't communicating with the other. And actually I'm ambidextrous, so it kind of proves that I'm integrated brain, not a split brain. Because, you know, you have right-left issues in your brain controlling one side of the body and all that. And so my being ambidextrous proves I don't have a split brain. But anyway, as I'm doing The Real Me, I'm throwing in little pieces of my original music from different periods. And that tune just stuck out as something I wanted to speak to. And I wrote a lyric for it, and I sing it now. And now it means something completely different. But it's I'm very proud of the lyric I wrote for that song.
I took a ride out on the freeway. I took the long way trying to get home. But you know, it's a drive I shouldn't have to make. The road was too long, the path was a song, it's too much to take. Why did the one side want to dominate? Why did the other hide in plain sight? I knew it wasn't a choice, I didn't hesitate. Just to make it all one, the deed was no fun, to make it all right. But I was the only one to see it all from the start. Cast it inside, went for the ride, didn't know why in my heart.
a whole new world of wonder. You know the mind is a key, the happiness free, there's no one to blame.
I think this is the first CD that you've sung on. What prompted that?
Well, it's stereotypical that a woman that plays the bass has to sing. And I figure, hey, I'm in this genre, I better sing.
Lefty Leaps In seems to be one of your standards.
That was from the CD of the same name. That was the name of my third CD, Lefty Leaps In. And that was one that got played on the radio back in the day a lot. So I wanted to re-record that one as well. And Josh plays the heck out of that, my piano player. And so I wanted to put that one and get the right name on it.
Any future projects you'd like to talk about?
Oh, there are so many things I want to do. I want to write more original music. I have a few things that I'm working on. I have so much music that's written of other people's music that I've been writing arrangements for years. I did, about 12 years ago, I did a small group treatment of West Side Story that's never been recorded. And my trio performs that stuff.
That sounds wonderful.
And we get a lot of requests for it, and it's quite popular. And I'd like to record that someday. So I'd like to record a record of all vocals. Of many things. And I've had a lot of people bugging me to record solo bass. I did a solo bass tune on the tune called Out of This World on Two for the Road, and then I did Kenny's song on The Real Me. And I've had people bugging me. The bass geeks want me to put out a all bass record. Yeah, I mean, if I had unlimited funding, I could put 6 records out next week, you know. But you have to sort of plan ahead and get the finances in order and before you decide to go ahead with anything. It's hard to decide.
Is there any questions I should have asked you?
Goodness. Well, you know, one thing that I've not really talked about too much that. What you were asking me something about trans, but what I could offer to trans musicians. And I think in a general way, trans people who are dealing with the media, whereas when a trans person transitions, it seems like all of the media people want to talk to that person that's in to the early stages of transitioning or just before surgery. And once a person has transitioned, and has been living successfully and is pretty much assimilated and fairly well adjusted, it seems like the media doesn't want to pay any attention to those people. And part of it is because trans people that have assimilated, most of them want to be stealth and they don't want you to know about their past. But there are more and more people who are coming out who just don't even want to bother with trying to be stealth. And who aren't, frankly, aren't ashamed of any of it and don't really care to hide it. And those kind of folks are not getting the same kind of media attention as, you know, the Susan Stantons of the world. And it seems like the mass media wants to jump on the angst. They feed off of that angst about it. And they're not really showing that, hey, this can be a really happy story, you know. They want to focus on the broken families and the job loss and the discrimination. But when somebody gets to the other side and they can successfully transition and the hormones take their full effect and you've had the surgery and you feel so much better and you feel great, I mean, that doesn't get covered very much. So, like, unfortunately, the whole subject matter of the transsexual in the media, they generally cover more the court battles and the custody battles amongst parents and the job loss and all that. It's not, they don't tell the happy stories.
We're winding down the interview, and by the way, you can find out more about Jennifer Lightham and her music at www.jenniferlightham.com. And Lightham is spelled L-A-I-T-H-A-M.
Hi, this is Jennifer Lightham, and you're listening to Queer Music Heritage.
I'm down to the last song, but before I get to it, I want to thank you all for listening, and I want to especially thank Jennifer Lightham for the wonderful interview. And there was much more from the interview that I just could not fit in the radio version of this show, so my internet listeners can hear a little longer show with a lot more comments and additional music. That, of course, can be found at www.queermusicheritage.com. And as always, if you have questions or comments about any of the music I featured, please write me at qmheritage@aol.com. This is J.D. Doyle for Queer Voices on KPFT in Houston. We talked earlier about how the album, The Real Me, is the first to feature Jennifer on vocals as well as bass, and one of my favorite tracks from the album gives you an excellent taste of that. Closing the show is Jennifer Lightham and Stick It In Your Ear.
Remember when the sounds you heard were crisp and clear? The melody and harmony were soothing to hear. But nowadays music seems designed to give you only fear. Well, stick it in your ear. The times have changed and romance is a thing of the past. Cro-Magnon ways and dog-eat-dog pervade to the last. I wish there was a way to keep from crying in your beer. Well, stick it in your ear. The time was when all you heard was melody and harmony in sync with the dance. Nowadays, the medium hasn't a chance till the last, but then it's the past. So I hope that there's a way to rise above the crowd. Some future generation will make us all again proud of those who came before, who didn't pander to their fear. Stick it in your ear. Dance now.
that there's a way to rise above the crowd. Some future generation will make us all again proud of those who came before, who didn't pander to their fear. We'll stick it in your ear.
You have been listening to Queer Voices, heard each Monday at 8 p.m. here on KPFT, a publicly funded Pacifica Network station. Queer Voices is produced live in Houston with recorded segments from This Way Out, which is produced at KPFK in Los Angeles. Queer Voices executive producer is Jack Valensky. On-air voices are Glenn Holt, J.D. Doyle, Deborah Bell, Jennifer Renee, Greg Chapman, and Jack Valensky. Be sure to listen every Saturday night, Sunday morning at 1 a.m. for After Hours with Jimmy Carper. It's Queer Radio with Attitude. This is listener-sponsored and commercial-free Pacifica Radio, KPFT, at 90.1 FM, 89.5 FM Galveston, and worldwide via streaming audio from kpft.org. For Queer Voices, I'm Glenn Holt.
In the early morning hours of Monday, August 13th, an unknown person fired a gun from a passing vehicle into the studios of KPFT, narrowly missing a volunteer DJ. I'm KPFT General Manager Dwayne Bradley, and I want to thank you for your thoughts and prayers. This incident has drawn international attention and prompted important discussions about free speech and violence. The needed security upgrades could cost KPFT tens of thousands of dollars. Visit kpft.org and click on the link on our front page to donate to help our efforts. Again, that's kpft.org to make a contribution in this difficult time. This crime remains unsolved. If you have any information that could lead to the arrest of the individual or individuals responsible for this felony, Crime Stoppers is offering up to a $5,000 reward. Call 713-222-TIPS. KPFT will continue to broadcast the programming you enjoy and will always be Radio for Peace. I'm Dwayne Bradley, and this is KPFT Houston.
We are looking for you, women and men between the ages of 16 to 24. Job Corps is designed to meet your needs. Not sure how to get involved? Call Tony Morales at 713-498-8090. He will be glad to explain what Job Corps can do for you now and for your future. Job Corps can make all the difference in your world because it's already worked for more than 162,000 students. KPEFT and Job Corps. Success is a lifetime. This is commercial-free, listener-sponsored, Pacifica Radio, KPFT, Houston.
Yes, yes, Africa is the land of a foundation. Yes. Mama, 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 mama. Ah, 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 ah. Mama, mama, mama.
This song mama, is dedicated
mommy, mommy.
To everyone.
The free program you just heard was paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a KPFT member, we encourage you to join with us in keeping free speech alive by becoming one. Basic membership is still $35 a year. You don't have to, but you'll feel better. Thanks for listening.